this is going to be like kind of goofy because you're in an office, but if you have a coat or a jacket, you can actually like hood it over the microphone and yourself, and it just kind of builds a bubble that'll keep that echo down. Live from the Mundangerous Green Room in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 59 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about world building with one of the most legendary and prolific world builders in the RPG industry, Monty Cook, creator of Planescape, Tolis, Numenera and the Cypher System, and now Invisible Sun.
So Invisible Sun is this new standalone RPG. It's developed by Monty and the team at Monty Cook Games. It features an entirely new world and cosmology that contrasts the gray reality of our own world with the bright, magical realities of other dimensions. It's sort of a surreal fantasy world, if you will. Players control PCs that can travel between the dimensions and discover truths about their own existence.
So tomorrow is the last day of the Invisible Sun Kickstarter. It's already fully funded, but this is your last chance to get in as one of the initial backers who get some access to some great extras. You can check out the game and see the Kickstarter at pathofsuns.com. We'll also have the link in the show notes.
You've probably already listened to a bunch of podcasts where Monty discusses Invisible Sun, which is why we waited until the Kickstarter funded so we could talk about other things as well.
Yeah, things like his inspirations, his creative process, how he crafts his immersive and detailed game worlds. We started off with the development of Invisible Sun, but, you know, we're D&D fanboys, so we really couldn't miss the chance to talk a bit about Tolis and a lot about Planescape and Sigil.
Speaking of Planescape, Monty told us what it would take to get him to work on Planescape for 5e, but you'll have to listen to learn for yourself. And just a note, as with all interviews, the audio isn't quite up to our usual standard.
No, but the content is way better than what we usually offer.
Yeah. So without further delay, the Total Party Thrill interview with Monty Cook.
So why don't you just start off by giving us the elevator pitch for Invisible Sun?
So Invisible Sun is a surrealistic fantasy. It is a world of magic, but it is not go by the normal sword and sorcery tropes. That was the elevator pitch, by the way. the longer version of that is that Invisible Sun is a world where we discover, we learn that we are actually beings of a much larger reality called the actuality, and that we have been sort of admired and trapped here in shadow for a long time. But we are going to move on and expand into what we call the actuality, which is the quote-unquote real world. And this is a world of just wild, imaginative craziness, basically. That's where the surreal part comes in. And player characters go out and basically are trying to uncover the secrets of the universe, right? You know, once they've learned that there's so much more to the to reality than they thought, they want to just keep going.
Can you talk a bit about the mechanics and the logistics of it? How can players get involved? How can they get involved in the Kickstarter?
Sure. So we've got a Kickstarter going on. It ends on September 16th. If anyone is interested, they can go there. They can also go to montycookgames.com and find a link there. The mechanics of the game are a little bit different, maybe even a lot different than those you'll find in other games, because Invisible Sun incorporates what we call a third mode of play. If the first two are just sort of action and the second one is just kind of straightforward narrative, the third mode of play is what we call character development or development mode. And development mode is played away from the table. So it is the kind of thing that you can do just one player and the GM, two players and the GM, and you create what amount to side scenes that go along with the regular narrative, but might focus in on something that only one or two characters wants to do, basically to elaborate on their own character development. And this can even include things that have already happened. These can be flashback scenes to further sort of flesh out a character's background. But all of these things, because you're actually playing through them, then turn around and feed back into and inform the group narrative as well.
So what's the mechanic for feeding back into it? Like, if I'm participating in sort of development mode, right, maybe with one other player, how do the other two or three players at the table then learn about what happened in maybe a flashback or something, a side scene?
A lot of it, actually, is going to happen narratively, right? So we have, for example, tied to the Kickstarter, we have a gameplay video. And in that gameplay video, you can see where the group of characters runs into an obstacle that they don't know how to get past. And the session ends, one of the characters thinks to herself, you know, in my past, I may have come here before. And so she talks to the GM, and she play out the side scene where, in fact, she had come there before. She, in the side scene, learns how to overcome the obstacle so that when the next regular session starts up next time, she shows up and says, okay, I know how to get past this, and just does so, right? And so it all happens narratively. Game mechanics-wise, what happens is the advancement is measured in story arcs, and story arcs have these story points along the scope of the arc. So in using a side scene from development mode, you might reach one of your story points, but you also might actually uncover a whole new story arc, for example, or start a whole new story arc that your character goes on, because characters can have more than one story arc going at a time, just like a character in any other fiction.
So those arcs are in lieu of what in other games might be levels, like character levels?
Basically, yeah. So you've got this arc, and there are a great number of different arcs that your character can go on. They're very general. You give them your own specificity based on, you know, who you are and what you are doing. So you might, for example, have, I'll just pick a silly example, right? You might have a revenge story arc, you know, someone killed your father and now you've got to find them and, you know, they must prepare to die, like Princess Bride. But along that story arc, you know, the first point might be finding the first clue as to where the person that you need to get revenge on is, and the set, you know, and it just goes and goes and goes until it reaches the climax. You find that person, and then there's a resolution. And all of those points are story points, and each one of those, when you reach them, you would get, we don't use the term experience points, but essentially what amounts to being some experience points that you can then use to unlock new abilities.
So then who decides what these arcs are? Are those arcs suggested in, like, towards the players? Are they something that the GM predetermines? Is it something that the setting material provides? Where does that come from?
You know, in this game, because of this whole story arc mechanic, right, it's in every game, right, the GM sort of encourages, you know, make up an interesting background for your character, right? And maybe someone will make up a few paragraphs or whatever. But in this game, it's sort of much more fundamental to the character to think about these things because it is going to determine how your character proceeds further, right? So it's a lot of it is up to the player. In character creation, you've got a lot of different choices. You're kind of choosing the order that you belong to. Everyone belongs to one of the orders of magic, for example. And when you make that choice is going to suggest three or four different story arcs that go nicely along with it. So there might be a general story arc that is, you know, find a mentor, right? And if you choose the order of Vance, it might actually say, well, you want to get this particular guy to be your mentor. And here are the four steps that you will have to undertake to get to him. So it's kind of all laid out in front of you. But of course, you could also choose to base your first story arc on some completely different aspect of your character. So there's a lot of choices.
How closely tied are those choices to the world that you've created? Can you tell us a bit more about the world of Invisible Sun?
Absolutely. Everything is really, really tied together. More so than in other games that I have worked on, the setting and the mechanics are really interwoven. So, for example, I mentioned that there are these orders of magic, and then you can also choose to be an apostate, which means that you reject the whole idea of orders. But anyway, so there's these five different orders then, if you count apostates. And so these are character options that you can choose, and they're going to inform like the abilities that your character starts out with. In fact, they're going to inform how you utilize the magic in the world. There's the Order of the Vance, and they look at spells as being these living, intelligent things that they sort of cram into their brain, and they can only hold so many of them at a time.
So this is a Jack Vance homage?
It is, very much so, right? But then there are weavers, right? And they look at magic completely differently, and they take like different aspects and they weave it together sort of on the fly and create their own spells, you know, moment by moment. So these are tied to the different orders, and so that's a mechanical choice, right? You're making that choice to determine how your character does stuff. But at the same time, those are actual organizations that also exist in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So they also determine how you fit into the society in this world. Most of the characters are going to start out in this city of Saturnine, which is in a place that we call Indigo. If you imagine that our world, and I mean like Earth, the way we think of it with podcasts and things like that, that's what's called the gray. It's also called shadow because it is metaphorically a shadow of Indigo as seen in the light of something called the invisible sun. And the invisible sun is sort of the source of magic in the world. But there are all these other suns. So each one of them are tied to a particular color. There's the indigo sun, there's the gray sun, but there's also the blue sun, the green sun. And each one of them has a different aspect to it, a different connotation. So the green sun is sort of the sun that represents life. The blue sun is the sun that sort of represents relaxation, imagination, dreams, that kind of thing. Red sun is about change and destruction. And they all form what's called the Path of Suns. And the Path of Suns, you can see on pathofsuns.com. What it kind of creates is this very occult-looking symbol that indicates sort of a map of the actuality. But the idea is that it is also a map of the human soul at the same time, because one of the concepts of this world is that the external reflects the internal and the internal reflects the external. So you might, as part of your character, be tied more or less to one of these suns, one of these aspects of reality, but they are also places that you can literally go to, right? You can go to the red and you find that it's actually this really dangerous, terrible place filled with demons, but you can go there. But it also is a metaphor and a metaphysical place that represents change and destruction.
Like, why am I not surprised that Monty Cook has created this entire cosmology with, oh, I don't know, a faction tied to each color?
It is very Planescape-like in some ways. I think that probably the most Planescape-like thing I've done since Planescape, really.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we're due for another Planescape.
So. We are owed another Planescape.
It has been a while, hasn't it? Yeah.
So with Invisible Sun, I'm sort of interested in when you're starting from scratch, I guess, right? And saying, all right, I'm going to develop a new game and a new game world. Where does that start? Did you begin with mechanics and go, okay, I need to create these different orders that people work through in order to fit these mechanics? Did it go the other way? You say, all right, I've got these five ways that people could use magic. What would those mechanics be?
In this particular case, it definitely started with the world. And in fact, it started even maybe a step earlier than that, which was really, really diving headfirst into the surreal. The thing that thrills me about that is that, you know, there's all this great sort of metaphorical, imaginative art that's out there. And it's not really ever meant to be taken literally, right? You look at some science fiction or fantasy book cover, right? And it's got all this imagery and you know, it only sort of makes sense as a representation, not as a specific depiction. And so my inspiration was, what if I took all that art and made it literal, right? That is actually a place. You know, I spent a lot of time looking at that kind of art and what would that world be like and what would that mean? And obviously it's a world of magic. I wanted to create a world, obviously, that's very magic heavy, but was very like people had sort of figured that out, right? People understood that the world's filled with magic. Magic is the thing, right? And so it led very quickly to this idea that there would be, you know, these different sort of schools of magic, which eventually became the orders. And, you know, you could progress through the orders. But I knew in the moment I had that idea that I wanted you to be able to progress through these orders. And that would represent not only your character advancing, like, you know, your stats and whatnot, but it would represent you moving through the order, you know, as a character, right? That it would be a part of the stuff that your character thinks, not just what the player thinks. So when you say that I'm a third degree Vance, you can say that in the world and that means something.
So who are the orders then? Are they people who left our world previously and have been in either Saturnine or in the Indigo for a long period?
Most of them. So everyone who uses magic in this world, which is sort of like all the movers and shakers, right? They call themselves Vizslay. And that's because all of the different sons that I was mentioning, each has a guardian, or actually a pair of guardians. And the guardian of the invisible son, so the sort of the person, not person, being sort of in charge of magic, so to speak, is an entity called Vizsla. And all Vizsla sort of at least pay her lip service, at least give her a little bit of reverence. So they call themselves Vizsla. And there was a terrible war in the fairly recent past. And most Vizsla actually fled into shadow. And that's why we assume we are all Vizsla. That's why we're here. And we've been here so long. And the sort of the lie of shadow is so strong that we forgot.
Wait, so is that an origin story for humanity? Or is it just why we have like magicians in the world?
Yes.
Okay.
And so the idea is that without the Vizsla, the gray is just literally a shadow. It has no real truth to it. It has no real meaning to it. But since the Vizsla all kind of hid out here, they exiled themselves intentionally to avoid the war. It probably gave the gray, it probably gave shadow a great deal more power and substance than it once had. And it became a trap. It's almost like inadvertently the Vizsla trapped themselves in the gray. And so now the Vizsla that didn't go, or the Vizsla who have escaped, sometimes come and try to help people get out of shadow and back into the regular world and indoctrinate them, which is an interesting thing because some of them might be doing that for altruistic motives, but some of them might have completely ulterior motives for why they want to do that. But in any event, the idea is that the player characters, actually, when you're sitting down to play the game, you've left shadow. That's sort of the default. And you are back. You know the basics and you're sort of ready to go back and start delving into the actuality. You could play a game that actually starts in shadow, but that's not sort of the default assumption with the game.
So where did the rainbow sort of structure come in? Was that early on, or were you sort of looking at it and going, oh, I think I have like 7 or 8 things?
You know, I'll be honest. I'm kind of self-aware enough to know that I seem to kind of always be falling back into using color as an important aspect of reality. It must just be something about the way my brain works because I keep kind of pulling back to that. It's something that's really easy for people to kind of hang on to, right? I mean, I think we all sort of associate colors with ideas and concepts, and, you know, I can play off of that. Plus, I can play off of old phrases and sayings like out of the blue. I can actually play off of that with the blue sun.
Yeah, I like that idea too. Just like when you take things literally, you know, like you said, surrealist paintings become literal, turns of phrase become literal.
Yeah.
It has like that bleed over effect, right? Where maybe that's something that's leaking out of Indigo.
That's kind of my thinking too, right? That it is, maybe it's a half-remembered idea that now we think of as a metaphor, but it's actually something that we're remembering from our true life that is actually real.
Like green with envy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how solved is the invisible sun setting? I guess what I mean by that is, like, we talked to Keith Baker about Eberron, and there are these unsolved mysteries that are sort of there for the GM to, you know, figure out on their own. Or like Planescape, there's not really a backstory for the Lady of Pain. It's sort of up to you, you know? But look at something like Forgotten Realms, and there are really no unanswered questions anymore.
You know, on that spectrum, Invisible Sun is more like Planescape. That's the way my designs lean. I mean, that's true of Numenera as well. I'm sort of more interested in questions than I am in answers, to put it that way. But I think that's a particularly interesting for a role-playing game setting, because it means that any game master can come up with the answers that he or she wants, as opposed to just reading about it in a book and then sort of regurgitating it to players. Now, there'll be some ideas that will be secrets to the player characters to start out with that they will discover as things go on, of course, that are revealed within the game, but there'll be plenty of things for the game master to kind of start to explore themselves.
Yeah, so speaking of secrets, I know one of the pledge levels involves Monte Cook Games actually sending secrets, unique secrets, to GMs and to players, right?
Right.
So how, as a GM, how do I integrate that? You know, what kinds of secrets are these that I'm then...
What are they? Just tell us the secrets.
No. But you know what I mean, right? Like I have an idea for my campaign and where things are going, and then you guys come in and send a secret to my players, and all of a sudden my campaign is like, well, that's a different direction now all of a sudden.
Oh, I see. Okay. There are secrets tied to all the backer levels, in fact, and they are all setting-based secrets. And so, for example, everyone is going to get a secret, because based on when you back, we're moving through the Path of Suns, right, as the Kickstarter goes on. And it's a different sun is active about every 2 days. And so depending on under which sun you back the Kickstarter, you get a different secret. Which means right there's 9 different secrets, and those are all setting based, right? And so everyone who backs under the red sun is going to get a specific secret, and that secret will be something along the lines of, you know, a cool place that maybe exists within the red sun that someone can go investigate. And it's not like, if I don't have the red sun secret, I can't use the red, right? Because it's just one little thing, right? If this was the Forgotten Realms, right, it might be some cool little village in Cormyr that we're kind of giving you a few details about, but you can certainly play Forgotten Realms without that. But your Forgotten Realms campaign in Cormyr might be a little bit cooler because you have that. But I think what you're referring to is actually the directed campaign, which a whole different thing. And it involves a lot of stuff. Basically, it's a month by month, we're kind of feeding you enough story material and information and stuff for you to run a whole campaign. But one of the things that we will do as a part of that is send the game master like actual physical props in the mail, but we'll also send the players, with your permission, with their permission, we'll send the players stuff too, right? And so that might be like an invitation to a party or whatever. But because that is a part of the directed campaign, the player will get an invitation to an exclusive party, but then the information that the game master gets that month will be what's going on at that party. So it won't be like a complete surprise to you. It won't be like,
okay,
we're not going to derail your campaign by sending your player some weird thing. It's all integrated.
So getting back to world building, I always wonder, is it ever frustrating as someone who has built many, right? And you know that people are playing their games in these worlds and making up stories. Is it ever frustrating to you when you hear someone tell a story and like inside you're thinking, no, that wouldn't have happened. That's not at all how it goes. What are you doing? But outwardly you need to be like, oh, that's really interesting.
I totally see why you would ask that. But actually it's the exact opposite is true. I love hearing about people's stories, you know, when they've taken something that I've done or they've set an adventure in a world I've created or whatever. And, you know, my feeling is like, as soon as it leaves my hands, as soon as that book leaves the printer and goes off into the world and it lands on someone else's game table, then that's theirs, right? And so, first of all, they have the right and maybe even the duty to just, you know, completely change it if they want to or do whatever they want to with it. Well, it's flattering, first of all, right, that they would even do that, right? I have, you know, oh, I, you know, made this adventure for Numenera or whatever. Cool, right? That's awesome. But it's also really, I don't know, it's invigorating, right? It's a feedback loop, right? I create a world, I send it out, someone else does something, has a character or whatever that lives in that world, they tell me about it. It's like I've inspired them and now they're inspiring me back. You know what I mean? So it's like we're both getting something new out of the deal.
I find that so interesting. It's almost sort of the opposite of the stories you sometimes hear about people who write literature. Because it's sort of like this word of God, like I control the entire lore and like you absolutely can't change a thing.
Right.
And I feel like players sometimes get in that same mindset. Like, you know, obviously Planescape was second edition, but everybody was always trying to like come up with a third edition, fourth, fifth edition versions of it.
Right.
And the arguments between people are always, well, that's not Planescape. Like, that wouldn't happen. Like there are no Warforged in Tolis. Like, come on.
Right. For me, that's what separates role-playing games from, you know, just writing movie scripts or writing a novel, right? Is that there is an interactive element to it. There is an expectation on the part of the end user that they will create new stuff, that they will change and shape and whatever. If there wasn't, you would just be reading a novel. In the same way that a good game master is going to expect that his players or her players are going to do something unexpected and crazy and creative, you know, with the narrative that is set forth, I think that a good game designer expects the same thing.
It's almost like you're writing the story with the expectation there's going to be fan fiction.
yeah. Well, you know, I actually think that the best way to look at it is that game designers aren't storytellers. They're story enablers, right? Mm-hmm. We're kind of providing the tools for other people to be storytellers.
Well, so in that vein then, Ishan asked you if it was frustrating, but what's something that you've heard from a player playing in one of your settings when you heard it, you just thought, man, I should have done that. That should be canon. That's better than what we had.
I remember that actually happening a lot with Planescape, actually. You know, that was back in the 90s. Planescape was still extremely edgy. I know that it probably doesn't seem that way today, but at the time, you know, we had just moved out of the whole era where, you know, we were still calling them Tanari and Beatazu, not demons and devils, and you know, TSR was an extremely conservative company, and so as much as we pushed the boundaries, as much as we, you know, did things that were kind of weird and cool, I would hear back from players. Way back then, it would have been on the TSR AOL message board. Were they even called message boards? I don't know. The AOL TSR site. And, you know, I'd hear back in the... And I wish I could remember some of the particulars, because they were particularly the things that people were doing with Sigil, where it was just like, wow, that's really imaginative and cool. And, you know, I always realized, wow, we're still a little gun shy, right? We're still keeping things a little conservative. It's still, you know, sword and sorcery, straightforward kind of stuff. And, they're doing all kinds of crazy, surreal, imaginative things.
So then you were like, well, forget it. We're just going to kill all the gods.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess we got a little crazier as time went on, right?
They were good times. I had a character who eventually ended up marrying the Lady of Pain, which is, in context, like, that seems weird, but, you know, it made sense at the time.
That is weird, but I want to hear that story, because that doesn't...
God.
Right? I mean, in context, that doesn't make a bit of sense, which makes me really...
No, I mean, it was after they killed Vecna, so, you know. So with Planescape, you know, this was, like you said, it was the 90s, and that was a while ago at this point. Is there anything that you learned from making that? I won't go so far as to say a mistake, but like, if you want to volunteer a mistake, that sounds good, that you kept in mind when you're creating Invisible Sun. You're like, I don't want to do that, or that was a little too difficult.
I don't know if it's right to call it a mistake, because it was sort of a decision that was, I don't think there was another way to go, but Planescape relied very, very heavily on real-world mythologies and whatnot. And, you know, some cool things came out of that, right? That we kind of took every real-world mythology that there was and then also took the mythologies of Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms and everything, and we just mashed them all together and threw a bunch of other stuff in there too, right? And I think there was an interesting synthesis from that. But I certainly... from that experience, learned that with creating Invisible Sun, I wasn't going to tie any of it to actually real world myth or occult or anything. That's a topic that I'm fairly well versed in. I'm fairly well read in the occult and things like that. So it's very much informed by that and inspired by that. But there aren't any Hindu gods or you know, things like that in this game. You know, the Path of Suns itself is certainly reminiscent of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, but it's not the Tree of Life, right? We have a deck of surreal divinatory cards called the Sooth deck, which is a lot like the Tarot deck, but it's not the Tarot deck, that kind of thing.
So we won't see any explanations for the role of real-world religion in the gray.
Not really. The only way that I'm going to play around with that is narratively from within the story, right? So you might have an NPC who, you know, maybe they were a devout Catholic and then suddenly found themselves, you know, in the much larger world of the actuality, and they still try to impose their Catholic beliefs on things. But for me, that's a completely different direction. That's kind of going from the inside out rather than the other way.
Right.
I think most people who, you know, create or write, you know, RPG world builders, obviously like rely on their own experiences and things that they find interesting to inform the kind of work that they do. Is there any kind of theme that you can see through the worlds that you have created? Is there like a similar story that you're trying to share? Because I will say you do have a lot of prison planes.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, that is very funny, because certainly one of the themes of Invisible Sun is one of escape, right? In fact, I'm looking up at a board right now, and I have all these words written on it that are kind of inspiring. And one of them, in fact, is escape. And, you know, from the point of view of RPGs, good RPGs, good entertainment of any kind is an escape, but also from the sort of the in-world way. And that does show up probably a lot in the work that I do, but it's a metaphorical escape. It's a escape through realization, right? It's realizing that, oh, things are bigger, weirder, more wonderful, more horrific, whatever, than I thought they were. And so, you know, whether that be, you know, it's kind of a Lovecraftian theme, really, if you want to look at it from the dark end of things, right? Lovecraftian heroes all discover that the world is bigger and far more terrible than they thought it was, right? So there's a lot of ways to play that idea, but I think that does work into a lot of things I do.
A bit like the truth will set you free.
Or screw you over. Exactly.
So So do you do that for all of your settings that you create? Do you have those sort of those lists of thematic words that you set out with objectives that you're trying to hit, or is that how you start?
Very often, yeah. You know, as a creator, when you are, you know, especially when you're creating a world, right? It's so easy that you kind of get down in the weeds and you get really down in the details, and suddenly you're creating stuff and you find that you've gone way off the path because you're doing something and you forgot the big picture. So I always want to try to keep the big picture, you know, because that's what keeps the world of Invisible Sun, the world of Invisible Sun. And that's what keeps the ninth world of Numenera, you know, that, right. And keeps all of those things from just sort of bleeding all into each other and, you know, or into something that I didn't even create. Right. You know, for example, like when I talk about Invisible Sun, right, people will say, oh, I see, that's kind of a little bit like the Matrix. Oh, I see, that's a little bit like, you know, this other thing. And those things are true, but I want to make sure that I don't allow it to bleed into one of those things too much. I imagine most creators are probably thinking along those lines.
So actually, can you describe the board that you're looking at for us?
Sure. So you guys are familiar with the musician Brian Eno? I'm sure you are, right? Mm-hmm. He created this whole list of weird, like creative, I don't know what you'd call inspiration prompts. And so they're really interesting. Like when you're stuck on something, in fact, it's actually, he made them into a physical set of cards that you can draw. And so I don't have the cards, but I was looking at the list, and one of them was discover your recipes and abandon them. Right. And so mm-hmm. the idea there, of course, is, you know, discover the kinds of things that you always kind of fall back on and try to do something different. And I don't think that he means like in big, big ways, but like in the smaller ways, right?
So not colors, right?
Right, right. But maybe, you know, maybe I should have. Too late now. you know, and then I've got some pieces of art here. I have a big image of David Bowie, who's a kind of the creative muse of Invisible Sun in a lot of ways. The fact that I really started like full time working on Invisible Sun just as his album Black Star came out and he died was kind of weird for me. So I've got a bunch of art, escape, surreal. Oh, I have a little mantra. This is one I came up with on my own, and that is, when faced with a choice, do both, right? Which is another kind of creative prompt, right? Like, again, to use an absurd example, you know, should I make this guy a good guy or a bad guy? Well, what if we did both, right? What if he was somehow both of those things at once? So that always makes things more interesting, I think. So that's kind of what's up there.
So what's your process like for creating? I heard Salman Rushdie said, oh, he like gets up, he works from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock. He writes the whole time like a job and then he stops. But I don't know, for a lot of people that doesn't necessarily work.
No, that wouldn't work for me at all. I'm very much a night person, very much a night owl. In fact, from a lot of people's point of view, I probably live my days backwards, right? I get up, and that's like when I go to Netflix and watch a movie or something like that. And then I go and check email and do those kinds of things, check in with the rest of my team and whatnot. But then my actual work day where I'm writing is all in the evening. I probably get in maybe 5 to 6 good creative hours a day, but I probably don't start until 8 or 9 in the evening.
Well, so speaking of which, you mentioned Netflix, but who are the people, and what are the media that are really inspiring you lately?
Well, I sort of only half jokingly refer to Invisible Sun as being Harry Potter if it was written by Philip K. Dick. I would say Dick. You know, I've long been a big fan of Grant Morrison, the comic book writer. Everything that he does is just trippy and weird, and just sort of so filled with ideas. And then right alongside him, Alan Moore, who's written a ton of interesting stuff about magic and the occult and things like that. Is very inspirational for me. On top of that, you know, I have this whole table over here that is filled with books on the occult. I get a lot of inspiration from that. Like I said, none of it is sort of directly lifting that stuff, but just inspiring stuff. And that's kind of straightforward stuff like Crowley and Spare and people like that, but also kind of more weird out there people like Kenneth Grant. I don't know if those names mean anything to you, but...
Well, Crowley does.
Yeah.
Crowley's like the one name in the cult, right?
Right. Right. You gotta know your Crowley before you can even start on anything like this.
So with all of these things inspiring you, I think something that's very hard for a lot of creators is then taking all of that and figuring out what is good, what is not so good, or at least not useful in this particular moment. Like, how do you prune and refine? How do you pull it all back?
So just to talk specifically about Invisible Sun, I've been working on Invisible Sun for a long time in the sort of concept stage. I've only really started working on it, you know, full time for the last 4 or 5, maybe 6 months. So what I do is, as I'm going through, I've got all these notebooks, and I just every time I read something, come upon something that's just like, wow, right? I make a note in one of these many notebooks that I've scattered all over the house. And so when it comes time to actually work on it, that's almost like the crazy first draft, right? It's just all these scattered ideas and notes and whatever. And then the next step is going through all that, and that's where pruning things out, right? Because sometimes, you know, you get weird. You know, I have these two cool ideas, but I can't use them both, right? So you got to kind of make and pick and choose, or you know, you think, well, I don't have room for all of these things, right? But so I've just got to pick. And you know, when in doubt, right, I try to go with something that's the most original or sort of has the most wow factor. For me, that's why I read. That's why I play RPGs. And so that's kind of what I try to get out there, is just kind of those ideas that just make people go, oh, right. That's my drug, right? That's what I do. That's, you know, why I'm consuming this media. And so that's why I'm creating.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the things that resonates about the worlds that you create with players, right? Is that wow factor element. So, you know, there's no doubt Numenera and Planescape, right, just evoke so much of that for people who get involved in it.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so, right? I mean, even sort of the more kind of straightforward D&D work that I did, you know, something like, you know, Return to the Temple of Elemental Evil still had some, hopefully, some moments where people were like, oh, wow, that's crazy, you know?
Wow, they let this module go to print for the first time.
Who came up with these DCs? Well, yeah, no, I think that speaks to the success of that, right? There's still wow moments, but it's a recognizable, you know, quote-unquote normal module.
Right. I mean, that's always the trick, right, is you've got to give people kind of a really strong, mind-blowing sense of wonder, but at the same time, you know, they've got to have something that they can relate to, or else it's just dream sequence after dream sequence, right? That doesn't really have any substance to it.
So how do you know when you're done with all the tweaking and the refining? Like, how is a world done?
So I think the first thing you have to do is you have to abandon that idea, right? That it's not going to be done. And so what I try to do, and this is probably a lesson that I learned mostly when I was working on the big setting that I did, Tolis. And that is approach everything from the point of view of the end user, right? And so most of the time that's going to be the game master. And do they have enough to run a cool game? And when you can say yes, then I think you're not done, but you're done for now. Right. Because there's always going to be more. There's always, and in fact, I think it's important that there's always going to be more, because again, we're going back to that idea that you know, the game masters and the players are, they're going to be creating stuff too. If you're done, I mean, you know, if you have every single, you know, building in the Forgotten Realms that is completely mapped out and, you know the stat of every villager and, right, and you're done, well, then there's no room left to really do anything.
Yeah, that's like a life's work.
Yeah.
not a recommendation for any world builders out there.
Wait, so Tolis isn't done? Does that mean I'll get answers about the Metal Storm at some point, someday?
Maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, what's the status of Tolis? Could that come back now that there's the 5e OGL?
I guess the answer is yes, it could, but it's not on my radar. I do what I do because I love doing it. And what I love doing is creating. And so the idea of going back to something, you know, like doing a new version of Tolis doesn't have a lot of appeal to me because that's not creating, it's just updating. I don't know the context in which I could do this, but like if it was a brand new adventure set in Tolis or something like that, that would have more interest for me. But in order to pull that off for 5e, you'd have to update Tolis to 5e, you know, it's a catch-22.
If, for example, the DM's Guild got opened up, you know, outside just the Forgotten Realms, is that anything that you think you might be interested in releasing anything there? Or is that a marketplace that you are looking at all?
I don't think so. I'm not an expert on that, but I don't think that that's a marketplace. I think that that's a fantastic marketplace for people who aren't already game publishers. That would be a difficult marketplace to have some success in if you have the expectations already of having been a publisher, I think. I don't know. Is anybody doing that? Like, I don't know of any publishers that are using the DM's Guild, but I could be wrong.
No, I don't think publishers. I think Keith Baker had talked about being open to going back to Eberron a little bit.
That's cool. I mean, you know, like, if somebody said something, if Colin Nicomb and Ray Valise, Michelle Carter all got together and said, hey, we're going to use the DM's Guild to put together a Planescape product. You want to write part of it? It'd be hard to say no to that just because it would be fun and nostalgic. All right,
so Planescape fans, you've heard what we have to do.
So get on this.
You've got your four story points that we need to hit on this character arc.
That is exactly the way to look at it, yes.
So I have one more Invisible Sun question for you. I know the numerology of the Kickstarter has been a big mystery. All the numbers in there are odd numbers. They're not rounded off or even.
Right.
So I know we haven't solved the numerology yet, but where did the inspiration to introduce numerology as a mystery, as a mechanic of the setting come from?
You know, all of it just comes right out of real world occult stuff. Not the connotations that numbers have in Invisible Sun, because everything in Invisible Sun is new, but it was inspired by that idea that, you know, you open up pretty much any book on the occult and they're going to start talking about, well, this has this significance and its number is 5 and, you know, and that kind of thing. And so kind of trying to portray that. And here's what I love about that is that it becomes the thing that you can use as a metaphor, but also in a literal sort of ways, right? So I can start to, if I say, for example, that, you know, indigo represents truth and its number is 4, then I can start to use the number 4 to have a significance as it relates to the idea of truth, completely bypassing the middle ground of indigo, right? And so now just 4 represents truth, and that's a thing that I can use you know, in world building, right? I can have, you know, 4 people get together and call themselves the, you know, the Council of the One True Way. And there's a reason. I mean, I didn't just pick 4 all of a sudden, right? There's actually a reason, an in-world reason why there's 4 of them. And that kind of thing, it just, it's fodder, right? It's more and more tools in the toolbox when you're world building to have that kind of stuff. And so, I mean, no amount of world building is ever going to be as rich and deep and cool as the real world, right? But the more you can sort of copy that, right? And that's the way the real world works, right? We have all these kind of references and ideas and connotations and correlations. And so if you can throw some of that into your world building, I think everything just feels really rich and cool that way.
It also seems like a sort of an advanced creative technique. Like I will make some tools for myself and just sort of lay them to the side here. Perhaps I will use them later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot like that in there, right? There's, I mentioned the Sooth deck, right? And the Sooth deck is like a tarot deck, sort of. But like a deck of cards, it has four families, like kind of like having four suits. And each one of those has a number of correlations, you know. So the suit of secrets might be tied to, I don't actually remember off the top of my head, it might be tied to like ravens and fire and, you know, swords, right? It might be. And so you've got all these different kind of like, you know, pieces that you can play with and make these connections to, right? It's the kind of thing where, like, if there is a connection between ravens and swords, then, you know, maybe the coolest sword in the world has ravens etched along the blade, and players pick up on that stuff, right? They're like, oh, I know why it's like that. That's cool.
So that actually sort of reminds me of like one thing I did want to get into, which is, I think one thing that players really love about the settings that you put together is the slang, or like new words and languages. And, you know, you're just talking about like ravens or, you know, the number four and truth. And that seems like they're useful building blocks to create new kinds of slang and new kinds of words. But can you just talk a little bit about like how you come up with new words or new meanings for old words, right? Because like Planescape sort of uses an old cant.
Right. So I wanted to create something like that for Invisible Sun, and specifically thought about the Planescape cant, for example. And the Planescape cant, you know, it's based off of Victorian cant, and it has kind of this sort of rough back alley kind of, mm-hmm. you know, these are a bunch of con men and thieves, you know, in the way they talk. And so I knew I didn't want that. I wanted, for Invisible Sun, I wanted things to be a little more sophisticated, right? Because speaking in just the broadest of generalities, right? If that means that sort of the core Planescape character is like a roguish thief, you know, a con artist, the sort of broad strokes core character in Invisible Sun is going to be sort of the sophisticated wizardly type guy, right? And again, just super broad strokes here. So I knew that I wanted to create something that was much more sort of sophisticated in the way it sounded and the way that it looked on the page. And so, for example, everyone calls themselves Vislay. It's a made-up word, obviously, but it sort of looks like a classical word. When you see it on the page, it looks like something taken out of, you know, some classic textbook or something like that. And so that's kind of what I was going for with that sort of thing. And there are lots of other words like that. I'm also just a big fan of words. And so I have this whole shelf of just collections of weird old words. And so there's a lot of words that I throw out in Invisible Sun that sound like I made them up, but actually they're just kind of archaic and weird. And it's fun to pull stuff like that out because it sounds right. You know, when I call a spell Evanescence, right? Well, you might think of the 90s band, but, it is, you know, it's a real word and it has a meaning and it's cool and that, and it describes the spell, but it also just sounds, you know, better than, you know, calling something like vanish or invisibility, if you call it evanescence, right? There's a different connotation. There's a different flavor there.
Yeah. I think evanescence should bring you to life, right? And I'm done.
It's quality. So Monty, yeah, that's all the questions that we've got. We won't keep you forever, even though we easily could. But yeah, this has been awesome.
Cool. Yeah, you guys have great questions. This is a really fascinating discussion.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. And I mean, not that you need any luck because you're way past goal, but congratulations on the Kickstarter.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we're really happy. All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Bonnie.
So, Shane, obviously there was a ton of great info in there, but I've got to say I'm actually most excited that Monty clearly said sigil and not sigil, like some people like to insist you pronounce the City of Doors.
Yeah, those people pronounce GIF with a hard G, so you can't trust them. Moving on, we're actually skipping the Character Creation Forge this week because we're running way long, but let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
Another great way to support the show is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
All right, so what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're continuing our series on player profiles, and we're talking about casual gamers.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're actually building the Old Man of the Mountain.
Well, that's it for episode 59 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.